From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Keith Fleming remembers the year he turned 16. He was released from a psychiatric hospital and went to Manhattan to live with his gay uncle, the celebrated novelist and biographer Edmund White. Fleming's new memoir is called The Boy with the Thorn in His Side. Also, Rudy Belmer talks about editing a book of memos and letters from producer David O. Selznick, who made Gone with the Wind. The memos offer insights into how Hollywood used to work. The book has been republished in a new series edited by Martin Scorsese. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. GOP presidential candidate George W. Bush outlined a plan today for changing Social Security by allowing workers to invest part of their payroll taxes in private accounts. The Texas governor said it would give workers the chance to manage some of their own retirement money and help the economy by encouraging investment. Vice President Al Gore, Bush's Democratic rival, said the plan may look good while the stock market is booming, but it could hurt workers whose investments don't pay off. A spokesman for the vice president said the Bush plan could put the government in the position where it might have to rescue workers who lost their money in bad investments. President Clinton is praising the women who came to Washington this weekend for the Million Mom March for Gun Control. He says Congress should listen to their pleas for tougher gun restrictions. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton used his appearance at an annual ceremony honoring police officers slain in the line of duty to press the case for tougher gun laws. He wants Congress to require trigger locks on handguns, ban the importation of large ammunition clips, and close the loophole that allows gun purchases at gun shows without a background check. The bill has been stalled for 10 months. The president says he hopes the Million Moms March will help break the stalemate.
Yesterday on this mall, there were somewhere between 500,000 and 750,000 mothers gathered, and over 1 million in 70 sites across America, to say that we shouldn't wait any longer for this kind of legislation. I hope we will listen to what they had to say.
He says he doesn't want to take guns away from law-abiding citizens, just keep them away from criminals so that more children and police officers stay alive. Mara Liasson, NPR News, the White House.
The Supreme Court has ruled against 20,000 ranchers in 13 western states who claimed they had a right to graze livestock on millions of acres of federal land. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Salt Lake City.
The unanimous Supreme Court ruling rejects an old but increasingly challenged axiom in the American West that ranchers have a congressionally conferred right to graze cattle and sheep on 170 million acres of federal rangeland. Ranchers asserted that right in a lawsuit against Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt. Babbitt made it easier for non-ranchers, like environmental groups, to acquire federal grazing leases. He also made it easier for federal land managers to reject renewal of leases for environmental reasons. And his policies gave the federal government ownership of the fences, stock ponds, and other improvements ranchers make on federal land. Ranchers say the ruling saddles their business with uncertainty and saps value from their ranches, making it difficult to get operating loans. Some ranches, they say, won't survive. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials gained 198 points, or 1.6%, to close at 10,807. This is NPR News. Ethiopia and Eritrea stepped up their border war today, with each nation claiming victory over the other. Eritrea claimed to have shot down two Ethiopian aircraft and killed thousands of Ethiopian soldiers. Ethiopia said today that it has gained ground on the western front of the battle. The two impoverished East African nations resumed their two-year border war last week after UN officials gave up an effort to resolve the dispute. Relief officials say the renewed fighting is draining away scarce resources as millions of Ethiopians face famine. A new study finds that a type of drug used to treat heart attacks may be dangerous for people older than 75. NPR's John Hamilton has more.
The study looked at Medicare patients given drugs popularly known as clot busters. These drugs can dissolve a clot that is cutting off the flow of blood to the heart, but they also carry risks, including uncontrolled bleeding in the brain. Researchers from Johns Hopkins wanted to know whether the benefits of clot-dissolving drugs outweighed their risks in older patients. Up to age 75, they did. But patients older than that were about 40% more likely to die within 30 days if they got clot-dissolving drugs instead of medications that just thin the blood. The results need to be confirmed by other studies, but the researcher said the unexpected findings show that new drugs need to be thoroughly tested on older patients before they reach the market. John Hamilton, NPR News.
New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani said today that he hasn't decided what treatment he'll get for his prostate cancer or whether he'll continue his bid for the U.S. Senate. Giuliani's prospects have been clouded by the announcements that he has prostate cancer and that he's officially separating from his wife. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Writer Ed White has chronicled gay life in America through his series of autobiographical novels and his books of nonfiction. He's an excellent writer and has been our guest several times on Fresh Air. So I was interested in reading a new, well-written memoir, which is in part about him, by his nephew Keith Fleming. On the opening pages, Fleming explains that in 1976, when he was 16, a troubled kid rebelling against authority at the worst moment of his adolescence, his Uncle Ed came to his rescue. Fleming had spent most of the previous year in psychiatric hospitals. His parents were divorced. His father wanted him to remain institutionalized, but his mother got him out by signing an emergency release order. Then she called her brother, Ed White, and asked if Keith could come live with him for a while. Ed White agreed. White was in his mid-30s then and at the beginning of his literary career. Fleming's memoir is called The Boy with the Thorn in His Side. I asked Keith Fleming if he had any idea whether his uncle was going to be pleased about his arrival or resentful.
Well, I think that what's interesting is that there'd been a kind of rehearsal 2 years earlier for this whole idea of my going off to New York and living with him. In other words, if I went to live with him at 16, at 14, he had shocked my mother by telling her, how about if Keith comes and lives with me in New York? At that time, she had said absolutely not, and she confided to me later that her thinking was it wouldn't be good for me to be living with a young gay guy who was going out all the time picking up men. But obviously she changed her tune 2 years later, namely because she saw me rotting away in this miserable adolescent psych ward. And suddenly her brother, my uncle, had become sort of the last resort for me in her mind. And in my mind, I suppose I was remembering that initial invitation he'd made to me. And so I wasn't worried that he was going to be annoyed.
When your mother sent you to New York to live with your uncle, how come she didn't take you in herself?
That's something that I kind of leave very mysterious in the book. And I think it has to do with, she and I are a lot alike in that we're very, we can be very temperamental and strong-willed sometimes. And it's my uncle who's so diplomatic and whose eyes seem to show so much more calmness. I guess that's a better way of saying it. My mother and I are both very intense people. And we'd found ourselves arguing about my not taking out the garbage, and it would turn into big arguments. So she must have been thinking, maybe he'll do better with Ed, who had already requested that Keith be sent to him 2 years earlier.
When Ed White was young, when he was, still a teenager, he had his own encounters with psychiatry. He went to a psychiatrist because he was gay and thought that there was probably something terribly wrong with that. The psychiatrist's attempts to convert him to heterosexuality never quite took. But do you think that his unhappy encounter with psychiatry helped him relate to your unhappy year in psychiatric hospitals?
Yeah. In fact, Very much so. I think that, for one thing, we each had these sensationally bad shrinks who also had a lot in common with each other. His shrink was someone who was completely confident that he alone could cure my uncle. And my shrink, too, felt that all other shrinks were softies, that only his hardcore treatment was going to cure me. And yet, for example, my uncle's shrink was always falling asleep during the sessions. And the same thing with my shrink, because he slept only 2 hours a night. He had something like 200 patients scattered all over Chicagoland in different hospitals. The funny thing is that my uncle and I also shared this funny vulnerability to our shrinks. We didn't realize how terrible they were then. We felt that we were freaks who didn't quite deserve to be part of the human race. My uncle, because of his homosexuality, and me, because of this terrible, terrible acne that I had. So we were fatherless for all purposes, my uncle and I. We each had a divorced dad who we weren't seeing much. And so we were very vulnerable to this psychiatric authority. And only later did we both realize, oh my God, that was a monster that was trying to treat me.
My guest is Keith Fleming. He's written a new memoir called The Boy with the Thorn in His Side. And it's his coming-of-age story that includes the year that he lived with his uncle, the writer Ed White, in New York. Ed White is now a celebrated novelist and biographer. Where was he in his career when you came to live with him?
He was very early in it. And I think that's what makes it all the more extraordinary that he was willing to take on a teenage ward like me. Because he was very poor. Where he was... a single novel of his had been published, Forgetting Elena, and it had sold only something like 300 copies, though one of these copies had been read by Vladimir Nabokov, who happened to be my uncle's favorite writer. And when Nabokov had been asked, who are the two best American writers today, Nabokov had replied, John Updike and Edmund White. But that was wonderful, the praise from Nabokov, but my uncle was very poor in 1976 when I first came to live with him. In fact, he was earning his living by ghostwriting a U.S. history textbook.
When you were a kid growing up, what did it mean to you that your Uncle Ed was gay? How was that treated by your parents, your grandparents, and how did you see it?
Yeah, well, I think that that's something that I found so interesting to explore as I was writing the early pages of the book, because I think it's in writing that we sometimes think. My uncle will often say, I don't know what I think about something until I start writing about it. And I found myself remembering all of these things I hadn't been so conscious of. I was 12 when I found out he was gay, and it was totally inadvertent. My mother and grandmother, Ed's mother, would often tell me that Uncle Ed is maybe going to get married to his friend Marilyn. But one weekend when I was with my uncle at age 12, I saw that there was another woman around, another woman who seemed quite mad about Uncle Ed. So I asked my mother, which woman do you think Ed's going to get married to? And then she sat me down, and it was a big scene, and it was, well, honey, neither. Your Uncle Ed is gay. Do you know what this means? And that word gay, to me, sounded more like, of course, I knew what it meant. I knew it meant homosexual. But I couldn't relate my Uncle Ed's being gay to what I heard on the playground, which would be, oh, those two kids are perverts and they play around with each other. For me, my sophisticated uncle being gay seemed like an entirely different thing, almost a kind of a stylistic thing. And I saw his being gay as being his very hip clothes that he would show up in, the ripped jeans, and the cigarettes that he smoked so elegantly, the way that he exhaled through his nostrils, his whole manner of talking, this sort of wonderful musical rising and falling. And so his being gay in a way was really a name for his sophisticated style.
For a whole sensibility.
Right, right.
You were a 16-year-old straight kid when you came to live with your uncle, Ed. Was it understood by all of his friends that you were off limits to them?
Well, you know, the funny thing is that I've forgotten it, but my uncle just the other day was telling me, he said, "Don't you remember when some of my friends came by one day and they were all camping around and saying, you know, aren't you going to go fruity to me?" And I can't remember it. But it must have happened. But I think the reason I can't remember it is it must have been only once. And in fact, my uncle's gay roommate very much saw me as a straight kid, and he would tease me by calling himself Mom. He'd say, "Hi, Keith, Mom's home."
What are some of the tastes or interests that you were exposed to through living with your uncle?
Mm. Well, I think the first one was the music that he was always playing on his record player. He would write at home, and he loved to kind of be bathed in music. And I was just an ordinary Midwestern kid who, you know, who's played folk music and so on and some pop music. But suddenly to be in this apartment with this very lyrical music going on all the time, this serious music, as my uncle sort of jokingly told me it was called. He loved Handel's Concerto Grosso, and in those old days with the turntable, the Concerto Grosso was so long that it was four records that would be stacked one on top of another, and it would sort of go on for hours. And I started loving this music and feeling that my own emotions were being deepened and ennobled and improved. And obviously, literature would be another thing. I came to Ed as a big fan of Kurt Vonnegut, and was told that Vonnegut was a strictly adolescent author. But the first books my uncle gave me were Lolita and Swan's Way and something called Lord Chesterfield's Letters to His Son. And it was certainly very interesting reading.
My guest is Keith Fleming. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Keith Fleming is the author of the memoir, The Boy with the Thorn in His Side. In the year that you lived with your Uncle Ed White in New York, this was 1976. This was like pre-AIDS. It was an era of a lot of partying and cruising that your uncle was participating in. And did he try to hide any of that from you and make himself seem more proper or whatever, more straight-laced? Or did he kind of talk to you about the lifestyle he was living and why he chose to live that way and what it meant to him?
Yeah. Well, I think he struck a wonderful balance. I think he still was able to continue his own highly adventurous sex life, but did it outside our apartment. And, you know, I think it could have been a little too weird for me if he were regular, if I would wake up in the night to the laughter of an orgy that he'd brought back to the apartment. So he kept everything out of the apartment. And instead, to me, he would always seem like a very glamorous guy. I mean, I think young people are always admiring people who seem to be out having fun. And that's the way he would seem. He would go out. I'd be doing my homework at the kitchen table at 10 o'clock in the evening. And he would have just been climbed out of the shower. Now he had his leather jacket on and his jeans, and he was going to go down to the village and go to his bars or maybe cruise over to... And he would tell me about this. He'd say, oh, last night I was cruising down in this old warehouse on the Hudson River and, you know, met the sexiest boy there or something. And
No, a lot of people would think, well, you were sent off for a year to someone who's, you know, a classic bad influence. He's out late at night, cruising bars, having sex with different people. You know, this is not something you expose an impressionable teenager to, et cetera.
Right.
Are there ways in which you think that he was, that what other people would have found to be a really bad influence was actually a good influence on you?
Well, absolutely, because he's a very civilized man. And just this book he'd given me, Lord Chesterfield's Letters to His Son, was, my uncle was very much a modern Lord Chesterfield. There was a place and time for everything. He would be, Lord Chesterfield advises people to never rise later than 10, no matter when they went to bed. And my uncle had this whole self-discipline. And during the day in the apartment, he was always working quite hard, and he had everything compartmentalized. So he was far from being a bad influence. He was actually an example of a highly productive person who manages to do it all. And the sexual shenanigans that he'd get into every night would only start long after the work day had finished.
You had a terrible case of acne when you showed up at your uncle's house, and he immediately talked to you about it, sent you to a good dermatologist, and it cleared up, or at least vastly improved. How did it change you when your face cleared up?
Yeah, well, before I talk about that, I just wanted to say that I think it was so amazing to me that no one else, that doctors and nurses and parents that it had never occurred to them, maybe this kid needs some kind of treatment here. It was a truly severe case, and I just felt like the Elephant Man or something. And so I think what I've heard from other acne survivors is that, well, sometimes parents will think, well, it's just a passing thing. It's not that big a deal. And it's a tribute to my uncle's empathy that he immediately grasped that this was the thorn in my side. This was the big thing. And yes, it instantly made me feel that I'd rejoined the human race. It was that dramatic.
He also sent you to private school.
Yes. And again, with as little money as he was making, that was, again, very quite extraordinary. I learned my uncle had had a fantasy when he was a teenager that he would be rescued by this wonderful New Yorker. And though in my uncle's fantasy, this wonderful New Yorker becomes a lover, it's interesting to me that a generation later, my uncle's old fantasy, he was now fulfilling the role of the wonderful New Yorker, playing the role that he wished someone had played for him when he was a teenager.
Your uncle has basically chronicled his life and times through a series of novels and short stories. And in chronicling his life and times, he's told a lot of the larger story of what it's meant to be gay in America in the 70s and in the 80s. And in that sense, you know, because he's such a celebrated and well-known writer, he's something of a public figure. So after he's kind of couched his life in fiction, here you are coming along and writing a nonfiction story of your life, which involves telling part of the story of his life. Did you ask him almost for permission to tell the story before writing it, or ask him how he'd react to it, if he would mind?
I think I might have, but what I think is interesting is that he calls his autobiographical novels autofiction. And since I know him and his life, as I read them, I can see that often they're pretty straight transcriptions from his life experience. And he sometimes will say, well, what I like about writing a novel is I don't have to make sure I know the date, and I don't have to check all the facts, and I can just write things, you know, sort of true to my feelings. So I would say, in a way, that my memoir is just taking his autofiction one step further.
One downside I could see about being Ed White's nephew and writing a book that is in part about Ed White is that if it were me, I admire his writing very much, and I'd feel like he was an editor sitting on my shoulder reading each paragraph and finding all of its deficiencies.
Right.
I think I'd find it very stymieing. How did you deal with that?
I actually didn't feel that, and I think that I've had a lot, you know, even though this is my first book and I'm 40, in my mind I've been a writer since I've been, you know, 20 or something. And I've had, in other words, I've always, I guess, had my, in myself, I've had confidence in my own writerly ability. Part of that might have begun when I was 16. My uncle would say to me things like, you know, you really have talent. You're going to be the last writer in America. which to me sounded impressive until I started to think, oh, actually, that's pretty sad. Like the last idiot who's still scribbling away in the age of video.
Are you close now with your uncle?
Yes. And he and I will actually be doing, I will be his opening act on his reading tour next month, which should be quite a trip.
Keith Fleming, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Keith Fleming's new memoir is The Boy with the Thorn in His Side. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, introducing the new performance lineup, the 9.5 Arrow and the 9.3 Viggen. Information available at saabusa.com and 1-800-SAAB-USA. And from Random House Incorporated, Bantam Books Division, publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, the story of the men who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Rudy Belmer, editor of a collection of memos by producer David O. Selznick. The book offers a look at an earlier era of Hollywood filmmaking. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Martin Scorsese is editing a new series of books that is republishing several classics about movies. One of them is Memo from David O. Selznick, which was first published in 1972. Selznick was the producer of such films as Gone with the Wind, The Four Feathers, Dinner at Eight, David Copperfield, Anna Karenina, A Tale of Two Cities, Made for Each Other, Rebecca, Spellbound, Duel in the Sun, and The Third Man. Selznick handled much of his communications with stars and directors through memos, and those memos are very revealing of Hollywood in the era of the studio system. The book was edited by Rudy Belmer, who joined us a few months ago to talk about the making of King Kong. We invited him back to discuss Selznick. One of the stars that David O. Selznick discovered was Ingrid Bergman. He was responsible for launching her career in America after she had already started making movies in her native Sweden.
That's correct.
And he felt very strongly that she had the potential to be beautiful on screen, but you had to be really careful the way you shot her, because if you shot her from the wrong angle, she wouldn't look beautiful. He wrote, the difference in her photography is the difference between great beauty and a complete lack of beauty. In fact, would you read an excerpt of the June 22nd, 1939 memo that he wrote about the importance of using the correct angles for photographing her?
Yes. Now, he's writing a memo in this case to the director of the film, Gregory Radoff, with a copy to Greg Toland, who was the cinematographer on the film. And this is just an excerpt. It's, once again, not a brief memo. But he says, the Toland tests of Miss Bergman prove indubitably what we have been saying since before the picture started, that more than with any other girl that I know of in pictures, the difference between a great photographic beauty and an ordinary girl with Miss Bergman lies in proper photography of her, and that this in turn depends not simply on avoiding the bad side of her face, keeping her head down as much as possible, giving her the proper hairdress, and not to make her look too big, and even more importantly, but for the same reason, avoiding low cameras on her, as well as being careful to build people who work with her, such as Leslie Howard and Edna Best, as well, of course, as the children beside whom she looks titanic if the camera work isn't carefully studied, but more important of all, on shading her face and invariably going for effect lightings on her. This means that there should not be a single sequence of the picture that is not staged for real effect lighting, whether it be morning, afternoon, or night, and so forth and so on.
How much do you think that advice was followed in her
movies? Oh, it was followed. Ingrid Bergman was a fairly large woman. And, of course, he was concerned that, you know, that her leading men would look smaller than she. And also, he wanted to give her a fresh quality. This was the time, as you know, of the plucked eyebrows and the heavy makeup and, you know, the glamorization process, which he did not want to use on Ingrid Bergman. He thought that she was particularly effective with a scrubbed look. Now, this was, again, contrary to current practice at that time. You know, glamour was the keynote. But he felt that she would come off best in a more natural state. So he had to fight this with the makeup people and with the hairdressers and with the cameramen. Not fight it, but insist upon going this route, which, of course, worked out very well. I mean, we know how Ingrid Bergman photographed, and it was part of what made her certainly a star for the American public.
Selznick and Ingrid Bergman had a falling out. I mean, he discovered her in America and made her a star. What was their falling out about?
Well, the falling out, she had been under contract to him for quite some time, and he was loaning her out, which was standard practice at the time, and of course realizing a profit on the loan out that she wasn't getting. But that was also standard practice. And after several years, she wanted to leave Selznick and go on and do other things. And there was discussions about who was going to pay what, you know, to get out of the contract. So Selznick, who was quite honestly very unhappy about this for a variety of reasons, because Ingrid Bergman was still a very, very big commodity that he had on his list. And he wrote a letter as though it was written by Ingrid Bergman to David Selznick, in which she recounted, Selznick recounted, in her words, all of the things that he had done for her since she arrived from Sweden, that made the point of what he had done and what she had wanted to do that he dissuaded her from doing, and what he had been able to arrange for her to do in pictures. In any case, the bottom line is, this was a letter that he hoped might change her mind. Unfortunately, it didn't, but it's a very interesting letter.
Would you read a few lines from this 1947 letter that Selznick writes in the voice of Ingrid Bergman?
Yes, this is, once again, a long letter, but one part of it here. This is in the middle of it all. He says, "Unfortunately for you," this, of course, is supposedly Ingrid Bergman talking, "when I returned from Europe and had everything that I wanted, I forgot all about my promises and statements through the years. I forgot everything you had done for me. I forgot my promises and even my letter. And I demanded payment for the picture which I asked you to give up and which you had given up and which could have been one of the subjects listed above, on which you would, of course, have made a great deal of money as well as absorbed your overhead, which was idle largely as a result of not making a picture, my not making a picture. It is true that I entertained the troops on my own insistent desire to do so, but I didn't see and still don't see why you shouldn't pay me $60,000 for having done so."
Yeah, and it goes on and on.
It goes on and on. And it is this listing of all of the things, you know, you had given me these directors, which you had insisted upon, and I was able to do this project, which I wanted to do, and you were able to work out the details, and blah, 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 and so forth and so on. So it makes a very good case for Mr. Selznick, quite obviously.
I think that his relationship with Ingrid Bergman early in her career and the way he paid such attention to how she was photographed and how she looked shows the attention that he took with his actresses. While he was making Rebecca with Joan Fontaine, he saw that the makeup men had tweezed her eyebrows, which really upset him. He hated tweezed eyebrows, and he wrote, "What can I do to get you makeup men to throw away your kits and your tweezers? The public is so far ahead of you all and is so sick of your makeup. You are all managing to contribute to the destruction of stars." And he was upset about the way Marlene Dietrich looked in one of her films. I'm going to ask you to read this excerpt of a 1936 memo about how Marlene Dietrich was looking. Tell us the context of the memo and read an excerpt for us.
Okay. Well, he made one picture with Marlene Dietrich, who was not under contract to Selznick. It was called The Garden of Allah. And it was photographed in Technicolor, which at that time, the three-color Technicolor was brand new. And, of course, Marlene Dietrich was an exotic glamour lady and had been portrayed that way. And, of course, had extreme makeup and very careful photography and what have you. But he was a little concerned, even though he didn't want her to look like Ingrid Bergman with the fresh scrub look. He was a little concerned about the excess here. So he was writing to the director, Richard Boleslavsky, in 1936. And he says, "Surely a little reality can't do a great beauty any harm. Would you please speak to Marlena about the fact that her hair is getting so much attention and is being coiffed to such a degree that all reality is lost? Her hair is so well placed that at all times, when the wind is blowing, for instance, or when Marlena is on a balcony or walking through the street, it remains perfectly smooth and unruffled. In fact, it's so well placed that it could be nothing but a wig. The extreme in ridiculousness is the scene in bed. No woman in the world has ever had her hair appear as Marlena's does in this scene, and the entire scene becomes practically unusable because everything's so exactly in place and the whole effect of a harassed and troubled woman is lost, etc., etc." And the hairdresser rushing in between takes to put each strand of her hair in play, you know. And so he was trying valiantly here to get a little naturalism into the exotica. He was not against glamour, certainly. And when it was appropriate, or not taken to extremes. But in the case of Joan Fontaine, which you brought up, and Rebecca, Joan Fontaine was supposed to be a very plain, you know, ordinary, non-glamorous, totally non-glamorous character in this film. And, of course, he wanted to keep it that way. That was part of the charm of the piece.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rudy Belmer, and his 1972 book, Memo from David O. Selznick, has just been republished as one of the first books in a series edited by Martin Scorsese, and it's the Modern Library The Movies series. We'll talk more with Rudy Belmer about David O. Selznick's memos after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Rudy Belmer, who has written extensively over the years about movies. And his 1972 book, Memo from David O. Selznick, has just been republished in a new film series edited by Martin Scorsese. And this book contains a lot of the memos that producer David O. Selznick wrote over the years to the people making movies with him. David O. Selznick is most famous for creating the movie Gone with the Wind and having quite a controlling hand in the movie's production. In the memos, he writes a lot about searching all over for an unknown actress to play Scarlett. Why was it so important to him to try to cast an unknown actress?
Well, of course, all of the top actresses at the time wanted to play Scarlett O'Hara. By then, the book had been a phenomenal publishing success, and it is a wonderful character. So the Betty Davises and the Loretta Youngs and virtually everyone in Hollywood was you know, ready to go and wanted to play this part. But he felt that people who had been stars for a while, let's take Betty Davis for an example, you know, they had already an image and they were associated with various characters and so on. He wanted to find somebody who was not known to the American public so that people would think of this person as Scarlett O'Hara, not as one of the stars portraying Scarlett O'Hara. He felt that it would enhance the portrayal if it was someone that didn't have that full laundry list of credits behind them. So that's why Vivian Leigh eventually came to play the part, because in America she was hardly known. She had done a few British films.
Now, he wasn't looking for an unknown for the part of Rhett Butler. He knew he wanted Clark Gable. In fact, he co-partnered with MGM, the studio that Gable was contracted to, so he could get Gable for the part. Why did he feel so strongly about him?
Well, he felt strongly about him because virtually everyone thought that Clark Gable was Rhett Butler. And I'm speaking of the reading public, which, of course, people that were reading this novel, you know, were in the millions. And there didn't seem to be any dispute. You know, there was no, well, there are four other people who... It was Clark Gable. There had been thoughts about, very early on, about Gary Cooper. There had been thoughts about Errol Flynn. But it was almost unanimous that everybody thought it has to be Gable. Well, of course, Gable was under contract to MGM. So the only way, as the time went by, that he could get Gable was to make a deal with MGM, not only to borrow Gable, but to let them distribute the film, put money in the film, and also own 50% of it. What a deal.
Selznick hired George Cukor to direct Gone with the Wind, and then fired him and hired Victor Fleming, who's also famous for directing The Wizard of Oz. And when he fired him, Selznick wrote, "We can no longer be sentimental about it. We are a business concern and not patrons of the arts." What insights do the memos by Selznick offer about why he got rid of Cukor?
Well, there are a lot of stories about that. There's nothing that blatantly says, "George, you're out of here." It was a combination of many factors. First of all, he was extremely nervous about this enterprise. This was going to be the biggest thing that he had ever attempted. There was a lot of money involved. He was uncertain. The script was still not right, and he was getting changes down on the set to Cukor every day, every hour. It was driving Cukor crazy. He had so many suggestions, and it was the first time that he actually spent a lot of time on the set second-guessing a director, which became a habit through the years after that. But up until that point, was not that way. There was uncertainty. There was uncertainty about interpretation. And finally, after a couple of weeks, it wasn't working. And I think both of them knew it. And that was that, although Selznick was very careful to place George Cukor over at MGM to do the women. I mean, he had nothing against Cukor. He just felt that in this instance, it wasn't working. So they shut down. And he took Fleming because Fleming and Gable were very, very close and had done several films together. And Fleming was an excellent director. He was top of the line. And he was just finishing up Wizard of Oz, believe it or not, and segued from the Wizard of Oz to Gone with the Wind and almost collapsed as Gone with the Wind was shooting. In fact, he did have to take a few weeks off since he was on the verge of collapse.
One of the things that's really famous about Gone with the Wind is the score by Max Steiner.
That's right.
Now, David O. Selznick nearly fired Max Steiner in part because Steiner wasn't writing quickly enough, and Selznick wanted Steiner to write from the script, whereas Steiner insisted on actually seeing footage before he composed. I'm wondering if you think that Selznick's control over everything was a blessing or a curse, or a blessing and a curse.
I think, Terry, what you just said at the end there, a blessing and a curse. Obviously, people didn't want to be controlled to the extent that Selznick wanted to control them. Now, Max Steiner had worked for Selznick ever since 1932, where they were both at RKO Radio Pictures, and Selznick was in charge of production. But, of course, Steiner was a workhorse, and Steiner, you know, was doing 9-10 pictures a year and so forth. And he had to squeeze in Gone with the Wind. Also, Steiner was not used to reading scripts. He wanted to sit down and look at the finished movie and then start scoring. That was the way he did it, because he felt that if you looked at a script and then started in, that the picture may evolve in a different manner. So why even bother with that? Let's see what the final result is, and I will be moved to compose to what I react to on the screen. So Selznick was concerned about this. Also, Selznick wanted to use, he was always a great fan of using classical music, and he wanted to use Southern music, of course, Stephen Foster and so forth, and the militaristic and the patriotic tunes of the day, all of which was fine, and which Steiner would have done anyway to a degree, because Steiner knew that you had to, you know, put in this material to give it the period flavor. But Selznick seemed to want to go even further than that, which Steiner rejected, because he felt that music that is identified and associated with something else, such as classical music, it detracts from what's on the screen, unless it's, you know, once again, a Southern tune or Dixie mm-hmm. or Rally Round the Flag Boys or something where it's appropriate. So they would have discussions and arguments about that. And, of course, what ended up was a fine score. It was generally original from Steiner, with some of these interpolated pieces from the South.
You reprint a memo that Selznick wrote to Will Hayes during the making of Gone with the Wind about the line, "Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn," which is, I guess, the most famous line from the movie. And the code, the production code, prevented him from using that line. The head of the office, Joe Breen, wouldn't give Selznick permission to use that line. So he wrote to Will Hayes, "It is my contention that this word, as used in the picture, is not an oath or a curse. The worst that could be said against it is that it is a vulgarism." Do you know what happened after that, how they fought it out?
They did fight it out, because it's hard to believe now, of course. But back in 1939, you could not use a curse word. And that famous line, "Frankly, Scarlett, I don't give a damn," which Rhett says at the end of the film, he didn't want to use something that would soften that. And he felt the only way you could do it was to have it just that way. But they did shoot a protection reading, just in case they lost the battle, where he didn't say that. He said something like it, but he didn't say damn. But in any case, they finally gave in, because he had convinced them. He did all this research and the fact that it wasn't used in that the fashion, blah, 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 blah. But you see, the Hayes office was concerned that if they did let it go, it would open up the floodgates.
Mm-hmm.
And that everybody now is going to say, well, wait a minute, you know, Gone with the Wind. And they did not want to make an exception because, as we all know, exceptions are used as an example. But somehow or other, he got around it. He had to pay a fine. I can't recall now. I think it was $5,000 or something like that, a fine to show that, you know, that, hey, this is, we're letting you do it, but you're not entirely off the hook. And it did, over the years, introduce more, but it wasn't something that happened on every picture right away.
My guest is Rudy Belmer, editor of the book Memo from David O. Selznick. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Joining us, my guest is Rudy Belmer, and in 1972, he edited a book of David O. Selznick's memos, and that book, Memo from David O. Selznick, has just been published in a new edition in a new series of film books edited and chosen by Martin Scorsese. Now, one of Selznick's claims to fame is that he basically brought Alfred Hitchcock to America from England and launched his American film career. What was their working relationship like?
Well, it's very interesting because Hitchcock had, of course, been directing in England for years and had been very successful, and some of his pictures had international fame, which wasn't always the case, of course, with British films. And he brought him over to do Rebecca. And, of course, Hitchcock was most anxious to come here because this is where it was all happening in Hollywood at that time. And, of course, the resources were much greater, and all of the things that you had to work with and the distribution and what have you. So he was delighted. Selznick and Hitchcock both respected each other, and Selznick let Hitchcock alone more than he did other directors. But he was very much involved still with the script, with the casting, the pre-production, that is, Selznick was on a Hitchcock film. But he usually let Hitchcock alone during shooting. But then Selznick became heavily involved again in post-production and editing and scoring and so forth. Now, for a while, this worked out all right. But as usual, and as is the case as time went by, Hitchcock wanted more freedom. And he was not thrilled with the overzealous Selznick. And Selznick, of course, became more and more and more involved in things as the years went by. And Hitchcock, of course, had established a name. It was Alfred Hitchcock's Rebecca, Alfred Hitchcock's this, that, and the other thing, where he became one of the best known of directors to the public at large. Most people in those days didn't know the directors. You know, they knew Cecil B. DeMille, Frank Capra, and Alfred Hitchcock.
That's right.
Really, that's about it. And before that, D.W. Griffith. But beyond that, nobody was really interested in the director's credit. And it certainly wasn't going to be above the title, but you had Alfred Hitchcock's blah, 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 Spellbound. Now, Selznick was very, very shrewd. He orchestrated this. But you see, he created a Frankenstein in a sense that, you know, then Hitchcock wanted out, as so many of the people who worked with Selznick over the years wanted out eventually because they could do very well elsewhere and achieve independence.
You've collected Selznick's memos in this book, and it seems to me one of the reasons why he must have written memos is that if you're delivering somebody your wishes in a memo, they can't talk back to you. They can't say, no, I won't do that because you're wrong because. They have to read it, and then they're expected just to act on it. Did
That's
people
right.
talk back to him afterwards? Do you know?
Well, of course, I'm sure there were a lot of irate people who would get these long-winded memos and criticizing something, and they would call him up on the phone, or they would go down to his office or what have you. In some cases, I think they were just thunderstruck and didn't say anything. And in other cases, they were hired hands, so they thought, oh, okay, I'll swallow my pride and go do what he wants. Also, of course, there were answers to some of these memos. Now, in the book, as you know, Terry, it's all Selznick's memos because, of course, the person who writes a piece of material, whether it's a letter or whatever, is the legal owner of it, even though somebody else has received it. So this is the Selznick version, because otherwise I'd have to get clearance from 9 million people to put their answers in there. But again, for the most part, there were not a lot of answers in the files. There were a lot of, references to things, but not long-winded retorts.
Did Selznick really write a memo saying that his funeral service should be simple and brief so that no one would be bored?
Yes, he wrote. That's right. And they followed that. They followed that dictum. And he was always afraid of people being bored, because he had a threshold of boredom, and he just wanted to move things along. Also, he was addicted to Benzedrine, and this is before the days when people knew exactly what harm it could do. So that's why he was working, like 21 hours a day and expecting everybody else to be fresh at 8 o'clock in the morning and at midnight.
Huh. Well, Rudy Belmer, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, Terry, it's been my pleasure once again, particularly going back to 1971 and 2.
Rudy Belmer edited the book Memo from David O. Selznick, which has just been republished as part of a series of republications of classic movie books. The series editor is Martin Scorsese. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Alcatel, providing integrated voice and data networks for the internet, enterprises, and carriers worldwide. At www.alcatel.com. From Random House's Crown Publishers Division, hardcover publishers of Patient Number One, a true story of how one CEO took on cancer and big business in the fight of his life, by Rick Murdoch and David Fisher. And from Putumayo World Music, presenting Miriam Makeba's new recording, Homeland and South African Legends, a collection featuring Johnny Clegg, Hugh Masekela, Ladysmith Black Mambazo, and others. Information at www.putumayo.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, a terrific film from England that has just opened here, Croupier. It's about a writer who becomes a casino dealer and returns to the world of gambling that he was born into. We'll talk with the screenwriter, Paul Myersberg, and the director, Mike Hodges. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.